Iowa kids are happier and healthier, on average, than kids in the rest of the nation, according to the newly released Iowa Child and Family Household Health Survey. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, I'll talk with Peter Damiano, the author of that study, about the different factors he looked at, what Iowa is doing well, and where we could improve. Ann Feilman of the Iowa Bureau of Nutrition and Health will be here to talk about Iowa's nutritional challenges, and then we'll talk about keeping happy, healthy kids safe, how to prevent accidents and injuries, and how to keep our kids safe from predators. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're going to talk about kids in Iowa. A recent study shows that Iowa kids are happier and healthier on average than kids in other states. We'll explore those findings. And later this hour, we'll talk about children's nutrition, what we can do to prevent childhood injuries, and how to protect our kids from people who want to hurt them. But first, we'll start the hour with Peter Damiano. He's the director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa and the principal investigator of the Iowa Child and Family Household Health Survey. Part of that survey was just released last week. Peter, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. Appreciate the opportunity.
And this survey, it's the only statewide study of health and well-being of Iowa's children. How do you collect all of this information?
Well, this started in just prior to the year 2000, and we were working with the Iowa Department of Public Health, and as you mentioned, at that time there was no study that looked in the health and well-being of children and families. And so working with the department, put together a survey instrument and cobbled together funding at that time to be able to make this happen. And we do this through a telephone interview process, and we work with the Social and Behavioral Research Center at the University of Northern Iowa that actually does the calling for us. And then we do a sample of families with children in the state and follow up with telephone interviews. That's a really a broad look at the health and well-being of children. We started with this being a health study and looking at a lot of the traditional measures of health, insurance coverage and health status and access to care. But then we really wanted to take much more of a public health view of this. And so we don't only look at those traditional measures of health. We look at things that such as what are called social determinants of health, things like safe neighborhoods and nutrition and physical activity, substance use, gambling issues, a whole variety of different things to really get a picture of what's going on with families in the state.
How many families do you contact?
With this one, we did about 2,500 families in the state, and it's varied a little bit. We did this, as I mentioned, first in 2000, then 2005. So then in 2010 and 11 is when we actually do the data collection, even though we call it the 2010 survey. And so this last time, we did about 2,500 families, plus we did an oversampling of minority children in the state because there's no other study that really looks at the health and well-being, primarily with African-American and Hispanic-Latino children.
So this data takes a really long time to crunch. once you get all of this information, there is a little bit of a lag time. So we're looking at a snapshot in time in 2010 and 2011.
Correct. And it does. It takes a lot of time to actually prepare for it. And we work with both the Department of Public Health, the Child Health Specialty Clinics, and a number of other partners within the Department of Public Health and other places as we, you know, the couple of years leading up to when we're going to do this. So what are the – we determine what's the focus going to be for this year. So, for example, in this one, we decided to emphasize some early childhood issues. There's a project called Launch, which is being done by the department in some low-income neighborhoods in Des Moines. And so we sort of tagged on and did some parallel work with that at the same time we're doing this. And then we've also focusing on the physical activity and nutrition, some adolescent health, although that might even be something more that we would focus on in the future. We didn't as much in this one. Insurance coverage is something that we always take a close look at, and we really have the best information about children and parent insurance coverage through this for the state, the largest sample that's collected on that topic. And then the minority health issue.
All right. And the bits of information come out one at a time, really. This chunk of information focuses a lot on medical care and medical insurance in the state of Iowa.
It does, but it does present some of those other social determinants. This is what we call the statewide study. So it's really that mile wide and not quite as deep. And then we also have released the early childhood one, and that allows us to go into the questions about early childhood in more detail. And that's what we do in each of those reports. So we do have sort of the basic information for all children in the state in this one.
So, of course, and I've just done it here today, the headlines say this is great news. And it really looks like with access to health care, Iowa is doing a pretty good job. What did you find?
Right. I think the headline is Iowa is doing well. I do need to add the but because there always is something. But yes, overall, Iowa is doing very well in terms of the health and well-being in children. If you think about first the health care issues, the health status of children is very good, a little bit higher than children nationally. And I should emphasize that everything that we are talking about is based on the parent self-report of things. And so for the types of studies that we do in studying the healthcare system, sometimes we will use survey data like this, but sometimes we'll use other types of like insurance claims data or something. And they each have their own strengths and weaknesses. Not want to get too much into that, but just so people remember, this is the parent self-report, and it isn't talking to the children. It is talking to the parents. So the health parents have reported their children higher in that 90% of the children reported to be excellent or very good health, which is higher than the national average. The rate of have children with having a special health care need, there's a series of questions that we use to try to capture that. It is actually somewhat comparable to what you might find in other places. Our insurance coverage is something that Iowa actually excels at and something that our state legislature over the last 10 years, let's say, has expanded coverage. And so we only have 2-3% of children in the state that are without health insurance coverage at any particular point in time through the expansion of the Medicaid program and then the what's called the Children's Health Insurance Program in Iowa is called Hawkeye. So all kids up to 300% of poverty are eligible for a public program if they don't have private insurance. And so that really has done a good job of picking up uninsured children. And so that's something that we've done. The parent rate is comparable to what it is other places because we don't have the same safety net program. But for kids, we do very well with that. In terms of having a regular source of care, again, slightly higher in terms of do they have a place where they can go. We used a new measure of what's called medical homeness. That's a big issue in healthcare and healthcare reform is not only can people get to care, but is the kind of care that they receive really that comprehensive care? Can they get to the specialists that they need to? And it's really important with children with special health care needs in particular. And about 80% of the kids in Iowa, which is pretty high for this kind of measure because it's really something that's just being introduced, although many providers are already doing a version of this. So our kids, again, are pretty good on that.
So when you say medical homeness, does that mean that the kids go to the same doctor's office repeatedly and the records are available to whatever physician they see? Is that the kind of thing we're talking about?
That's a part of it. And so now the whole movement towards electronic health records and the state is developing a health information network, which is going to allow electronic health records from different providers to be able to communicate. And so if you have a child that comes in that you haven't seen before, you'll be able to look at their record easily. This is being implemented right now statewide. So that is a piece of it, but it's also that the communication between the parent and the child is effective. Between the provider and the parent and the provider and the child are both very effective. And then the communication, if they are being referred to other practitioners, is also very effective or community services that they might need. Often, if you take that public health look at the health of these kids, they don't just need medical care to be healthy. They need other things, whether it's WIC or nutrition. And that was one of the things that we found. There are a lot of children that actually do have inadequate access to food in a way that was one of the surprises.
Well, and let's talk about some of the downsides. One of those that you found is that mental health facilities for children are lacking in the state of Iowa. What did you find about that?
Well, we didn't actually – that's almost a different – question outside the study. But yes, we do know that mental health services for children is one of those things that there is problems accessing that depending on what part of the state you are in. We did find, in particular in terms of mental health, that lower income children were more likely to have and kind of through a series of questions that we asked the parent to be identified as having mental health problems. And that's really sort of the but in everything that we found is that overall things are good. But among this group of low-income children, that's defined for our purposes as under 134% of poverty, which just so people kind of understand, that's about $2,570 a month for a family of four. Those families is sort of where the butt is for a lot of these different issues.
When we'll dig more into nutrition later on in the hour, but some of the reports in this survey seem to be a little bit contradictory. When 90% of Iowa's children rate themselves as in good or excellent condition, of course, that's their parents rating them, but 4 in 10 low-income families are low on food. Do those numbers jive, and how do they jive?
Well, they do jive because the overall health status for the lower-income kids is also lower. So where 90% were rated good, only 76% of those lower-income children were rated as being in excellent or very good health. And the proportion that had a special health care need was much, much higher. So almost a third of all of the low-income children were identified as having a special health care need as compared to 18% of those in the higher income group. So there is this pattern of problems, if you will, identified for those children in those low-income areas.
When I was reading through the results, I almost wondered, since this is a lot of self-reporting, if there was an Iowa Nice problem, if you had people saying, yeah, no, we're okay, we're doing good. But how do you account for that? How do you know that people are being honest?
Well, we obviously can't know that people are being honest. But when we do look across these questions, and we've done a lot of survey research in different areas, it is surprising when we think there's going to be what's called a social response bias, and people are going to tell us more what they think we want to hear, you'll see questions and responses that clearly people don't. And then so you hope across the whole population that that's true. And then we look at other ways to see, do the data make sense? And so we weight these data to represent the different populations in the state to also try to account for that. And then look to how do these compare to national norms when we can. And so in the end, we've got numbers that we're pretty comfortable that, yes, these are, you know, reasonably representative of the parent report about children in the state.
We've talked about how insurance coverage is good in Iowa. Medical homeness seems to be on improving and increasing in the state. What were some of the things where you thought policymakers need to take a closer look at this, and this is something we need to work on at a state?
Well, that's where it gets into these issues for the low-income kids. So both the health status, as we just talked about, was lower. One of the things that wasn't with the kids but with the parents that really jumped up in terms of insurance coverage was that even though the low-income kids were covered well, their parents were not. And almost half of low-income parents were actually without insurance coverage. And so about 11% of all parents but 48% of low-income parents were without insurance coverage. And that's because we don't have that same safety net. And I think it's important to remember it's not because these people aren't working. It has to do with where they work. 80% of the uninsured are working people and their families. It's just a question of where they work, and then if they work at a low-income job, there's no way they can afford it.
I'm talking with Peter Damiano. He is the director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. We're talking about the Iowa Child and Family Household Health Survey. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today we're talking about kids in Iowa. We're taking a look at the Iowa Child and Family Household Health Survey. Part of that was just released last week, and with me is Peter Damiano. He's the director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. In just a moment, we're going to also dig in a little bit more into nutrition and health of Iowa's children. Ann Feilman will be here. She's the bureau chief of the Iowa Bureau of Nutrition and Health. And then later on, we'll focus on what we can do to keep our happy, healthy kids safe. We'll talk about accident and injury prevention, and also how to protect our children from people who would like to do them harm. That's coming up a little bit later this hour. And as I mentioned, Peter Damiano is with me now. And let's talk about mental health a little bit more in depth. You explored parent and child mental health status. What did you find there?
Right. We found that, and again, this is the parent report about the child, that about 9% of the children in the state were reported to have needed some sort of behavioral emotional care. But again, that difference between low-income and high-income kids was very striking.
And so when you say behavior or emotional care, we could be talking about ADHD. We could be talking about
Correct.
Counselor support services, that kind of thing.
Right. And it would tend to vary, obviously, by age of the child and also by gender of the child. ADHD tends to be a little bit more common in boys, depression in teenage girls, that kind of distribution.
Mm-hmm.
19%, though, of low-income kids were reported to have needed it. And 12% had, through a series of questions that we asked, determined to have a high level of behavioral emotional problems. So, again, that disparity, if you will, between the higher income and lower income kids. And then we asked, because it was this about the whole family functioning issue, about the parents and the parent mental health status. And most of these are moms. About 87% of our respondents were moms versus dads. We asked that the person who was most knowledgeable about the child and the family, moms tend to be the ones that are the most knowledgeable about the children's health issues. And we found that 90% of the parents were overall in good mental health status, but 22% of the low-income parents had some indications of poor mental health as compared to 7% of the higher-income kids. And 10% of the lower-income parents had high stress, parenting stress, which again through a series of questions as compared to 4%. So you can just imagine you've got a child with special health care needs. We said more likely, you know, you've got just the income issues, and then you've got some of these behavioral emotional problems kind of thrown on top of it.
And when we're talking about these kids needing access to mental health care, are they getting the access to mental health care that they need?
For the most part, they are, from what we can tell. But there are problems, you know, as I mentioned, that we really are more aware of from other work outside of the studies in terms of access to behavioral emotional care for children, especially in different parts of the state, and especially when they need care to go to a specialist. A lot of the routine behavioral emotional care is provided by primary care providers, but there aren't that many mental health specialists, especially for children around the state. So that can be an issue.
Now, the in-depth report that you'll be releasing on nutrition and health among kids in Iowa, that'll be coming soon.
Right,
but
correct.
What did you find out from this survey? You said this is a mile wide and several inches deep, but
right.
What kind of snapshot are we getting?
Well, one of the biggest surprises to us, we asked for the first time this year about food security and whether the families had enough food or not. And again, disparity between higher income, lower, and which you might expect, but to the extent we were surprised. So, for example, when we asked about whether there was if you had enough food that to last because of cost issues, and 38% of the low income families did not always have enough food to last because of cost, as compared to 6% of the higher income kids. When we asked them about whether they had to skip meals or cut sizes of meals, again, 24% of the 1 out of 4 low-income families said they had to skip or cut meals on occasion versus 4% of the higher-income families. And whether they were ever hungry but did not eat because there wasn't enough money for food, again, 19% of the low-income families versus 2% of the higher-income families. So that's something – and we talk a lot about child obesity and eating well and all of those things. And if you don't have enough food – obviously, you're not necessarily going to do that, as well as the knowledge on how to eat well and all of that, which your next guest could speak to that
much
better than I.
Well, and we'll talk about that in a moment. When you compare these results to what you found in 2005, was there a greater amount of food insecurity, or was this the first time you really dug into that?
Yes, this was the first time that we had looked into that question, so that when we do that the next time, we might look into this even more
and try to see what's going on.
Well,
as you mentioned, these questions were being asked in 2010 and 2011, and of course, that was really at the depths of the recession. Were there policy changes that you think influenced the greater food insecurity or this level of food insecurity, or do you think that this was an economic thing?
Again, from what we can tell, I would say it's more of an economic thing. It is interesting because it gets right now into the whole discussion about the Farm Bill, and that a lot of the reason that the Farm Bill is not being passed has to do with what used to be called the food stamps program, now is called the SNAP program, and concern that we have too much by some that there's too much government funding for food assistance. But this would indicate that is pretty needed and necessary.
All right. Well, let's dig into nutrition issues a little bit deeper. Of course, we do hear a lot about nutrition and a lot about childhood obesity. In 2007, a survey showed that 27% of Iowa children between the ages of 10 and 17 were overweight or obese. We know that that problem has not gone away. Ann Feilman is joining us now. She's the Bureau Chief of the Iowa Bureau of Nutrition and Health. Hello, Ann.
Good morning.
And, of course, statistics are pretty meaningless when we talk about all of these different numbers from different times and different places. But when you look over the state of Iowa right now, what do you think our greatest challenges are as far as child nutrition goes?
Well, it's kind of a balance between the childhood obesity issue and the food insecurity issue. We have probably similar levels of kids at each stage. But overall, everyone needs a healthy diet, and there are ways to do that at both ends of the economic spectrum.
Since we've been talking about food security issues, what do you do at the Iowa Bureau of Nutrition and Health to work on helping to alleviate that need?
The Bureau of Nutrition and Health is in the Department of Education, and our primary role has to do with the USDA food programs for schools, the breakfast, lunch, after school, snack, summer feeding, and in the child and adult care food program as well for child care centers or adult daycare centers that are enrolled in the food program.
And, of course, a lot of us have heard quite a bit about breakfast programs at school. There have been a lot of news reports over the last few years saying that, you know, the problems that kids encounter often happen on the weekends or over the summer. You mentioned summer feeding programs. What kinds of programs are there in Iowa to help kids out during these times when they don't have access to school lunches and school breakfasts?
There are some organizations and sponsors that also offer a backpack program that students can take a backpack full of some foods to get them through the weekend home on Friday afternoons or the last day of the week at school. The summer feeding program has been growing, and it's not only schools, but we have other nonprofit sponsors throughout communities where there's a need to offer meals in the summertime during that gap. Then with the child and adult care food program, that's with the child care, which covers may cover some of the younger students after school and weekends and throughout the summer or vacation times.
Where do you see gaps that aren't being filled at this moment?
There's always room for more. They're not evenly spread across the state, but there's always room for more sponsors. In the summer is probably one of the hardest, especially the month of August. Many programs run part of the summer, but through the month of August is probably one of the harder ones.
We're talking about kids in Iowa this hour. We've been talking about the results of the Iowa Child and Family Household Health Survey. Parts of that were just released last week. With me is Peter Damiano. He's the director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa. Also with me is Ann Feilman. She's Bureau Chief of the Iowa Bureau of Nutrition and Health. And you're welcome to join our conversation as well. You can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Join us with your questions about food and nutrition for children in Iowa, with your concerns about the health and safety of Iowa's kids. Again, the number is 866-780-9100. And Anne, when we talk about these programs that try to address the food insecurity problem in the state of Iowa, the opportunities for kids to take food home from school on the weekends or go to summer feeding programs. What kind of nutritional rules do we follow with these programs? I can imagine that would be challenging in sending food home in a backpack for the weekend.
There's not a standard set for the backpack programs. So they're generally looking for, you know, protein items that don't require refrigeration and foods that are very easy for a child to open and eat, or don't require a lot of what would need an adult preparation, like heating and cutting and using, you know, sharp utensils or can openers and things like that. So they are looking for things that are easy to eat, but yet provide protein, you know, whole grains, nutrients, and things like that. the summer feeding program, as well as the school lunch, National School Lunch Program, both have nutrition standards. And you may have heard about changes in the nutrition standards for schools that went into effect July 1st, so that there are it basically doubled the amounts of fruits and vegetables that are offered, increasing whole grains, moderate amounts of meat or meat alternates. That hasn't really changed, not excessive amounts there. Low-fat dairy products are all part of the school lunch. And while there are some changes, it's not new for all of our school districts. Many of them have been heading this way over the last 5 years, increasing the whole grains and the fruits and vegetables available. There's a campaign out now. The school day just got healthier, and it's to get the message out that school lunch is a healthy place to eat. It has a variety. Variety and moderation were words that were taught me when I was in school, becoming a registered dietitian, and those have stuck with me. And if parents are looking for a pattern for supper, we have a moderate-sized meat alternate. We have whole grains, one or two servings, half the plates fruits and vegetables, and low-fat dairy. That provides you a combination of foods that, while they provide calories towards energy balance, more importantly, they're also backing that up with the nutrients that children need, the vitamins and minerals that they need.
Well, and as you mentioned, a lot of schools in Iowa have been working hard to make their school lunches healthier for a long time and trying to include more fresh ingredients, fresh fruits and vegetables in their meals. And some places have local programs with local farmers and that kind of thing. With the increased standards, doubling the amount of fruits and vegetables, is there any kind of guideline for where and what kind of fruits and vegetables need to be served?
No, there is within the USDA programs a Buy American clause, and there is a lot of encouragement and local geographic preference that's available for agricultural products that aren't processed. But at the same time, frozen vegetables and some of the canned fruits in the light syrup or juice even can provide additional nutrients at sometimes, a more reasonable cost. So it's a balance. While the fresh fruits and vegetables may appeal to children and that way help them to eat more of them, offering a variety, there aren't any fruits or vegetables that are outside of the guidelines.
Of course, lack of food is a problem for a number of children in Iowa. Too much food is also a significant problem for a lot of children in Iowa. What are you doing at the Iowa Bureau of Nutrition and Health to try to help combat childhood obesity and the fact that we have this abundance of unhealthy foods available to kids?
Well, the first thing about healthy is energy balance. So activity, balancing calories for your energy balance. So the activity, getting them active. We have team nutrition grants that work with students. We have a Superpower Summit coming up for middle school age students in October, and it is a day-long workshop for teams of students from schools to empower them to become health advocates at their school and look at activity as well as physical activity, PE, and nutrition and what's offered, within the school. Iowa is a little ahead of some of the other states in that in 2008 we passed the Healthy Kids Act, which addresses foods sold to students outside of the reimbursable meal program, so that vending and a la carte and those things do have nutrition standards in Iowa that they have to meet.
I remember a la carte not being particularly nutritious when I was a child, no. So I can imagine that's...
There's been some changes
right,
there.
That's, you can't eat nutty bars for lunch every day anymore, right?
Right.
So as you look into the future, what do you see as the biggest challenges facing Iowa in nutrition?
Well, I think with the changes in the meal patterns at schools and stuff, that we'll see more of the students become aware of fruits and vegetables. They are required this year for the first time to have a half cup of fruit and or vegetable on their tray to make it a reimbursable meal. So I think that as the younger ones especially become more familiar with the various fruits and vegetables, it will become a routine part and not such an unusual thing. And that's a way that parents can help. If the students are seeing these fruits and vegetables and whole grains at home, then it's not uncommon to them, and they're more familiar with what it is.
Anne, thank you so much for your time today.
I'm very glad to be here.
Anne Feilman is Bureau Chief of the Iowa Bureau of Nutrition and Health. And Peter Damiano, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity.
And come back when you have more findings for us.
And I'd like to have people go to the Public Policy Center website if they want to look at the reports, ppc.uiowa.edu.
All right, definitely. Peter Damiano is the director of the Public Policy Center at the University of Iowa and the principal investigator of the Iowa Child and Family Household Health Survey. In just a moment, we're going to talk about how to keep happy, healthy kids in Iowa happy and healthy. We're going to talk about accident and injury prevention and also how to protect our kids from people who want to do them harm. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's great to know that our kids are happier and healthier on average than kids around the rest of the nation. But, of course, moms, dads, teachers, and other adults spend a lot of time trying to keep kids that way. Lisa Roth is the research coordinator of the Injury Prevention Research Center at the University of Iowa, and she is with me now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
I'm good. What are some of the biggest dangers for our kids when it comes to accidents and injuries?
Well, really, today I want to talk a little bit about back-to-school safety. I think we all know that school is back in session and full in force. And I'm really wanting to speak with parents, caregivers, really anybody out there who's going to be out on the roadways as school gets back in session, and talk about a couple of simple tips and reminders for drivers as they see kids out on the streets.
Okay, what are some of the issues that we should be thinking about?
Well, you know, really this is an opportune time for parents to be proactive with their kids and take time to talk about safety, specifically if you have a school-age child who's riding the bus. So I want to talk about that, but also the drivers that are out on the roads with them. It's really being more alert, slowing down and looking for kids in those residential neighborhoods and school zones who might be riding their bike or walking to school or even getting off the bus. I think it's important for people to take extra time and really not being distracted as you're driving. I think that's a big thing for all of us with the technology we have in our cars, to really look and make sure you know about your surroundings.
For kids who are riding the school bus, I know a lot of parents feel nervous about that. There's street crossing, and of course, cars are supposed to stop for a school bus. But what do we need to tell our kids to keep them safe?
Absolutely. This is one of the big issues, and actually there was a new law enacted just last week on August 15th. It was Caden's Law, really looking at drivers who go around those stop arms of the school bus or maybe illegally passing a school bus. I think for kids getting off a school bus, it's very important that they're making eye contact with the driver to let them know when it's safe to cross, because there might be oncoming traffic that they can't see, just really passing way out in front of a school bus so the driver sees them as well, and just taking extra caution just as you would when you cross the street any other time.
And a lot of school buses, I've seen newer buses at least, have those things that when they put out the stop sign, there's also a bar that comes out from the front to keep the kids further in front of the bus, because of course the bus driver can't see a small child if they're right in front of the bus. Are those just a common thing, or is that something that's being required?
That's truly a kind of a newer technology that's really on newer buses you're going to see, and that's specifically to help protect a child from the school bus itself. So if they're out walking in front of that arm, much better chance that they're being seen by the driver. Also then allows the driver to make eye contact with the child and be able to kind of communicate to them what they're seeing on the roadway ahead or even in their rearview mirror. So it's a great technology that's been developed and something that's keeping our kids safer.
My daughter's been riding the school bus for the first time this year, and I've had a hard time convincing her that she needs to wait to cross the street until that stop sign is out. Is that something that I should be working even harder on?
Absolutely. I think we can't probably talk to our kids enough about that. It is so important because we know people are in a hurry when they're trying to get their own kids to school or maybe they're late for work. And again, the inattention issue, if you're texting or talking on your phone, you might not realize that stop arm is coming out. So it's very key that kids are waiting till the stop arm is fully extended before they begin to cross that street. And I think that's something that's probably bus drivers are doing some education with children on, but it never hurts as a parent to remind them.
Now, of course, a lot of kids being back to school means that we've got a lot of playing on the playground, a lot of after-school sports. Are there things that we need to be thinking about in those arenas?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, sports safety is pretty key with organized sports getting back going in schools, whether it be football, might be volleyball, soccer, any of those sports, plus playing on the playground. And I think supervision is a key issue, specifically for younger kids and elementary age kids. If there's supervision on the playground, just making sure that people are aware of the hazards that are around them. Sports specifically, I think it's really great to work with your child's coach to make sure all the proper safety practices are in place. Obviously, if you're in organized sports, you're going to have all the key gear that you need, helmets, pads, all of that, but really looking to make sure if a child is injured during play, specifically with a concussion, which you've heard a lot of talk about that we're making sure that they're ready to return to play and not returning them too soon. So being evaluated by a physician and really looking into those types of things.
Well, and this is not an organized sports, but of course a lot of kids are riding their bikes to school and back, and I see a lot of kids on scooters, and honestly, on bikes I see mostly helmets. On scooters, I don't always see helmets. Is that a problem? Are we seeing a lot of injuries because kids are falling off scooters?
I can't speak to the data on that, but I do think that is one of the things. We always say all heads covered. It doesn't matter if you have wheels under your feet, you need to have a helmet on your head. It's something that even though if you're just riding a scooter and it seems like maybe a less of a fall, it's something we need to be reminding parents to educate their children about. But I think the key thing there is parents need to model for their children. So often you might see a family biking on a bike trail or even a child on a scooter and parents on their bike, and you don't see a parent helmeted. And so that's sending a message to their children. So I do think it's important whenever you have wheels under your feet, put a helmet on your head.
And there was a while where wheeled backpacks were really common because we were all really worried about backpack injuries, backpacks being too heavy. I don't see wheeled backpacks nearly as often anymore, but are there still backpack concerns?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's really important now. Now, this might come as too late of information, but if some schools aren't in session yet and you're still trying to choose that backpack, I think it's really important that you choose one that has wide padded shoulder straps and has a padded back. The other thing you want to remind your students is to pack light. Help organize the backpack so you're going to be able to put, using all the compartments, pack heavier items closest to the center of their back. You know, you shouldn't be carrying something that weighs more than 10 to 20% of your child's body weight. So that's something you really have to consider when they're packing all of their school supplies and books in there. You should always use the shoulder straps too. I think students get in the habit of slinging it over one shoulder. That can really cause them some specific back strain and back injury. There are some schools that will allow rolling backpacks. You just have to check to see what the school's policy is.
All right, Lisa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Lisa Roth is the research coordinator of the Injury Prevention Research Center at the University of Iowa. And with the recent disappearance of Elizabeth Collins and Lyric Cook in Evansdale, a lot of us have been hoping, a lot of us have been praying, and of course, we've been worrying about our own kids. Bob Lowry is the senior executive director for Missing Children. We're going to talk about keeping our kids safe from people who want to hurt them. Hello, Bob.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today. And a lot of us have been faced with talking to our kids about how to be safe from people who might want to hurt them. And stranger danger used to be the term that everybody used, but what we've learned about the abductions and other kinds of predatory acts is that strangers are not the greatest danger.
Not always, and unfortunately, got in our mind what an abductor may look like. We, the man in the trench coat maybe standing on the corner acting suspiciously, and it's not always the case. In fact, many of our abductors are those who will do harm to our children or those are in our neighborhoods, known to many of us, known to the kids. So we don't teach stranger danger anymore because it eliminates those that will be probably more likely to cause harm to the kids. So instead, we talk to children about empowering them to say no if there's someone they're asking them to do something that makes them uncomfortable.
So what do we know about when our kids are most at risk? What are some of the danger spots?
Well, most of the time, what we see is I think the most dangerous time is from right after school, coming home from the school bus stop. Seems to be one of the more vulnerable times. It seems to be a time when the children may be alone walking home. So we encourage the parents talk to their children about staying in groups, staying with their friends, and avoiding conversations with people that they may not know or may make them uncomfortable.
What are some other danger times?
Well, I think that's probably the most heightened danger time. Of course, you know, the shopping malls are, of course, places where people have a tendency to congregate. And we often think, you know, well, just because this is a public place, this couldn't happen because there's a lot of witnesses, there's a lot of adults. But you have to keep in mind is that typically an abduction is more of a luring of the child as opposed to someone grabbing the child and running with them. Frankly, those are more rare instances. Most of the time when abductions are not really witnessed because they're so passive, the children go along voluntarily because this person has convinced them that they can be trusted or they give the child a story like, can you help me find a lost puppy? And that, frankly, I hate to say it, but that luring technique still works.
So, of course, we don't want to teach our kids to be afraid of the world and afraid of everyone in the world. What can we tell, particularly young kids, to help them watch out for people who might be trying to trick them?
Well, we just need the children to be talked to. Basically, we tell them that there are dangers in our world. We have frank discussions with our children, but the fact is that we also explain that they are rare, but there are people out there that are willing to hurt them. What we encourage parents to, especially with the younger children, is to keep the children in groups, like make sure there's some adult supervision there, someone watching over the children. But when you can't, if the child should come across someone who's making them uncomfortable or asking them to go places that may not seem, or asking them to go places, we encourage the children to seek a public place, maybe a grocery store, a convenience store, or maybe look for an officer in uniform that might help them. And if they can't find someone like that, an adult authority figure, even a mom with some children may be a very useful place for a child to go just to report that someone is asking them to go along with them.
So a mom with kids, that would tend to be probably a safer person who would be looking out for her own children's well-being.
You know, we often think of that. And, of course, you know, the mothers would also have an instinct about what may be going on and may be able to help the child, at least get that child in contact with the parents or even a law enforcement officer.
Do you suggest telling kids about some of the things that someone might say to them, things that might be send off red flags?
Yes, and I think what children need to know is that if they're asked to go somewhere with someone, to say no. Regardless of what the story might be, children will be, you know, the lost puppy thing is, like, as I say, it seems to be one that's one of the perennial favorites by the abductors, because the children have a tendency to be very trusting. And while we want our children to be trusting, we also want them to be very assertive, because it's those assertive children who we see time and time again who do avoid abductions, even when they're grabbed by an abductor. If they were to be grabbed, we teach the kids, kick, scream, bring as much attention to the situation as you can, run away. But whatever we do, we don't get in the car with anyone unless your parents have authorized that.
So when an adult asks a child for help, you mentioned the puppy situation, but is that something that we can just say to kids, you know what, adults don't usually need your help. If it's someone asking you to help them and your parents aren't there, just say no.
Yes, and you're absolutely right. You know, we had an attempted abduction just here in the Washington, D.C. area, and we caught it on videotape just within the last couple of weeks. There were people milling in that area. There were delivery truck drivers there. There were service people in that area, and that abduction was not even witnessed because it was so passive. That child went voluntarily along with that person. So we really urge parents to sit down and have those conversations with kids. Don't go with an adult. And you're absolutely right. There's no reason an adult would need the help of a child. And those are the things that children need to be told.
When someone asks a child to go somewhere with them, I'm sure they often say, well, your mom said it was okay. Are there other tells that we need to warn our kids about?
Well, sure. And, you know, parents need to tell their kids that I'll never have someone come to you unless you know about it in advance. You know, or if their children are picked up from school, we'll notify the school that we're sending someone to get you. But it will never be someone that you're not aware of that's coming. And we will tell you that in advance. So I think parents need to make that clear with their children.
And, of course, we teach our kids to be polite. How do we also teach them that it is okay to say no?
Well, as I said, it's the more assertive children that we see that escape the abductors. I point to the case recently in Philadelphia where an abductor ran up behind the child, grabbed the child. She's with her younger brother, doing all the right things in a particularly safe neighborhood. That children did exactly what we like to see children doing, is that is a kick, scream, bring attention to that situation, do whatever you can to get away. In this case, that child bit the abductor. He dropped her, and they were able to escape, and the abductor was apprehended a very short time later. Similar situation in Georgia at the Walmart. You know, a girl was in the store with her mother, and what children will do is they'll venture off into areas that might interest them in the store. In this case, an abductor was there. Grabbed the child, and she did exactly what she was supposed to do, and she started kicking, screaming. All this was caught on tape. That abductor dropped her, and he was apprehended as he was leaving the store. So, you know, and you're right, we do want our children to be polite, but we also want to empower them to say it's okay to say no. And if someone's trying to do something with you that you're not comfortable with or trying to take you somewhere, do whatever you can to get out of that situation. And because if they are successfully abducted, unfortunately, they will be harmed in some way. They'll be victimized.
Abductions are fairly rare. And, you know, we want our kids to have fun, to grow up, to have a little bit of freedom. How do you balance the fear and the danger, the very real danger, with all of the other things that are so important to kids?
Well, I mean, kids still have to be kids. And, you know, they're still going to have to go outside. They're going to have to be with their friends. But, you know, what we encourage is that they just take just standard precautions. And, again, you know, the younger the child, the more likely is they'll be with an adult figure. As children get older is when they start venturing out on their own. They get more freedom because that's what children want. But we encourage them to stay with people that they know, people, friends. You know, in the case of Lyric Cook and Elizabeth Collins, you know, you have two girls here together. You know, they're in a populated place, and again, no one witnessed what happened. We have no idea to this day what happened to those two children. But I think some speculate that they may have been lured away from that lake by someone, and that's a distinct possibility because we have no idea.
And what do you tell kids to keep them from being too scared? Because you want them to understand that there are dangers, but you don't want kids to be frightened of the world.
No, they don't have to be frightened of the world. In fact, that's a very good point. You know, we want them to function just as we would normally have them. We don't want them confined to their households or under the constant watch of their parents, because that's not a situation that you'd want. But I think, again, it's just important that we talk to the kids. We just make them aware. You know, as parents, you know, one thing that we would have them maybe avoid is areas where sexual predators may live. And those registries are available to the public. And that the kids would know that you may want to avoid these areas because there's someone there that could potentially give them some harm. Those are just a few things, but I think you bring up a point. You know, the children are still going to have to lead their regular lives. Child abduction is rare. We see it only about 100 times per year nationally here in the U.S., but that's 100 times too many, obviously. And cases like what happened to Lyric, Elizabeth Collins, are the things that really, I think, drive this point home.
Bob, we're out of time.
I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. Thank you so much for talking with us today. Bob Lowery is Senior Executive Director for Missing Children. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe.